following interview with Michael Lutrenko by William Burr took place in Washington, D.C. on May 23, 1988. The interview is part of a joint project by the Columbia University Oral History Research Office and the Foundation for Iranian Studies.
Mr. Lutrenko, I have some questions about your background. Can you tell me where you were born and raised?
I was born in the city of Scranton, Pennsylvania, November 11, 1946. Grew up in the family home in Oliphant, Pennsylvania, O-L-Y-P-H-A-N-T, a small town about 7-8 miles from Scranton. The town of Oliphant was an immigrant town, a coal mining area of Pennsylvania, the Anthracite Belt. Almost everybody in the town was connected somehow with the coal mines, and they were basically immigrants from the old Austro-Hungarian province of Galicia, lots of Irish, lots of Italians as well. But at the time I was growing up, it was a town where English was just one of the languages in the town. People were as likely to be speaking Polish or Czech or Ukrainian or Russian or Yiddish in the streets as they were English.
So you received your high school education in that town?
No, I went through grade school and junior high school in all of the public schools. Mm-hmm. For my 4 years of high school, I went to a Jesuit high school in Scranton Preparatory School. Mm-hmm. I was graduated from Scranton Prep in 1964, came to Georgetown University, the School of Foreign Service. Mm-hmm. I left Georgetown in 1968.
And from there, where did you go?
I left Georgetown. I was graduated in June of 68, and about 1 week later went into Peace Corps training with an assignment to Turkey. I left for Turkey in the later summer of 1968 after a 1.5 month language course in California. In Turkey, spent 2 years teaching English at Hacettepe University. From Turkey, because my Peace Corps group was thrown out of Turkey, the Peace Corps itself was thrown out, left Turkey in 1970 for political reasons. I had planned to spend the third year in Turkey. Since my plans went up in the air with the departure of the Peace Corps, I asked for another assignment to Iran. I went to Iran expecting to spend 1 year there, but ended up spending 3 years instead. So I was a volunteer in the Peace Corps for 5 years.
Hmm. I have a question about your education. When you were at the Georgetown Foreign Service School, did you expect to go to the Peace Corps pretty early on, or did you?
I did. This was the legacy of the Kennedy years. Uh-huh. It was, at that point, a very significant organization, and just appealed to my sense of ideals, and also I wanted to travel. The fact that the Vietnam War was going on was also a factor, of course, but it was really independent of that. If there had not been a war, I still would have gone to the Peace Corps. It was an excellent way to see part of the world that I could not have gotten to otherwise.
Now, you said your Peace Corps group was thrown out of Turkey for political reasons?
In 19... One of the fallout factors from the Vietnam War was an incredible growing anti-Americanism in Europe, in the Middle East. And it was also 1968-69, just like in the United States, for years of turmoil in the universities and the school systems of Turkey. The Peace Corps was looked on as a symbol of American imperialism, a spread of American influence into other countries. It conflicted, the idea of the Peace Corps conflicted very greatly with the growing sense of radical nationalism the Turks were having at that point. I'm not sure of the bureaucratic reasons for it. I was just a volunteer at the time, but the Peace Corps was a very visible symbol of the American presence on university campuses, in towns all over the country, and it was a symbol that both the Turkish government and the American government were prepared to sacrifice in order to restore some sort of normalcy, some sort of sense of quiet to the relationship.
Hmm, that's very interesting. Now, before you left for Iran, did you receive Persian language training?
No, left Turkey, had a few weeks back in the United States on vacation, and went immediately to Iran, started my Persian training there. And I studied Persian for approximately 2 months, 4 hours a day or so. The way I really learned Persian was to be assigned to a town where there were no Americans. I was the only native English speaker for several hours in any direction. And it was a matter of survival. If I wanted to survive, I had to speak Persian or Turkish. The town that I was assigned to for my initial year in the Peace Corps in Iran was a Turkish town in the middle of a Kurdish area. And so everybody in the town was trilingual, Kurdish, Persian, Turkish. I could speak Turkish to some extent. My Turkish was good, but it was the Turkish of Turkey, which was very different from the Turkish used in the town. I used that, though, quite a bit for vocabulary. And I simply picked up Persian because I had to. I had to be able to control my classes to teach. I wanted to have a social life, and in order to get necessities of life, everything from bus tickets to bread, you simply had to speak Persian or one of the other languages of the town. So I learned it that way.
I think you told me before you were assigned to Songor and Kermanshah province, is that?
Songor. Or Songor Kolyai. Songor hyphen O hyphen Kolayi. It means Songor and the surroundings. Was my first assignment. I spent a full year there. And at the end of the first year, was asked to participate in an English language seminar being given up in the Caspian by one of the small universities from a town near Tehran. At the end of the seminar, which was a very excellent seminar. It was an intensive language program for very select university students. At the end of the seminar, I was asked if I'd be interested in coming to the college for my second year in the Peace Corps. I accepted that and went to the Literacy Corps Teachers Training College in the town of Mamazan, M-A-M-E-Z-A-N, which was about 30 miles from Tehran, on the old road going to Mashhad. It was out going towards the desert.
I have some questions about your first year when you were in Songor. Were you teaching there also? You were teaching?
I was a teacher in high school, and I was responsible for all the English classes in two different high schools for the boys in the first year of high school. This meant boys who were basically, I had about 200 students all total. Each class was 3 hours a week, and I had four different classes. It was a light teaching schedule per se, but I was also teaching at night, teaching teachers and others who wanted special night courses, and especially helping out in special courses the senior students who were interested in taking the university entrance exams, and who had to be, their English had to be very, very good to pass the exams. I also did a lot of tutoring of individual Iranians who were interested, for free of course, it was part of my service, but just tutoring in English for individual Iranians who were not involved in the school system but were interested in taking the university exams.
Had the Peace Corps been active in this area before you arrived?
There had been one volunteer there before me, and I don't believe he had finished off his tour.
Was he also teaching?
Yes, he was also teaching.
What were social economic conditions like in this town?
Well, let's see. The town at that point had a population of perhaps 8,000 people in the town itself. Electricity had been brought to the town that year. It worked part of the day. Electricity was basic. We're talking about a town where most of the houses were built with mud brick, where there was no plumbing at all. Perhaps in a few of the government buildings, it basically outdoor toilets, outdoor pumps for water, which meant that for a significant part of the winter, everything was frozen. There was a rough winter there. Electricity at that point used to go off at midnight and would stay off until the next morning. It was a very, very rural town. The nearest city of any consequence was Kermanshah, because the road to Kermanshah was basically a dirt track over the mountains. It could take up to three and a half hours to get to Kermanshah. in the winter, the road was often closed, or it would be closed for a week at a time, for example. I got stuck on the wrong side of the closing, too. But rural, very rural. There were no cinemas in the town. Television, of course, was not feasible in that part of the country. People had radios. And very slowly, small tape recorders were coming into vogue. At that time, in 1970, when I was in Songor, there were almost no cars or motor vehicles in the whole town. There were buses, sort of primitive buses, that would service a Kermanshah. But on the bus, you were as likely to be sitting with sheep and poultry as you were with other passengers. They were general carry-all buses for carrying the villagers and the townspeople to the markets in Kermanshah. So you could be sitting there next to sacks of wheat or sacks of flour, a couple of chickens, baskets of fruit. Social life in the town was very restricted. It was a very conservative place. There was no alcohol in the town at all, except for one man who occasionally sold beer from the back of his house, and which I never touched because everyone in the street knew who was buying it. No television, as I said, limited radio reception. No cinema. Someone had tried to build a cinema in the town, and he had been warned that if he continued, he would be killed. He died when he continued, although it was always unclear how he had died.
For religious reasons.
There was quite a religious stir in the town when he announced the plans to build a cinema. And he was blasted from every pulpit for even attempting to do it. Social life was very restricted, segregated by sex, so that all of my social activities there were male-direct or male-oriented. There were sports or dinners, and my friends and I basically went from house to house every night to different dinners. We would sit around playing cards, playing chess, lots of sports activities, visits to the villages over the weekend, the villages that were, say, an hour or two or three hours in the direction of the mountains away from Songor. And for real entertainment, I would hitchhike down and visit other Peace Corps volunteers around the area. But that could be a 3-hour trip, 3-4-hour trip sometimes.
Was this an agrarian area? Was it a economy based on agriculture?
Totally. Agriculture, yeah. And sheep.
Yeah. Had the land reform program there had any impact in that area?
Yeah, land reform had come in and it had wiped out the upper middle class of village khans, the landlords. It had not particularly helped the villagers, as far as I could see. The villages themselves were extraordinarily primitive. I had no plumbing and only electric lines hanging from the ceiling with one light bulb. But if you went up to the villages, it was like going back into medieval times.
How much influence did the central government have in that part of the country? How visible was the central government?
Central government influence was always strong. There was a very large police station in the town. You would see gendarmerie, of course, all the time as well. And that sufficed. It was a town that was anti-central government. It always had been. In fact, there was a joke in other cities in the area, especially in Kermanshah, they used to refer to Songor as Leningrad. It was a town that had been very anti-Shah during the Mossadegh period. And a fair number of people in the town had political troubles. There were quite a number of executions when the Shah came back to power in the town.
53,
yeah. It had never been a particularly pro-Pahlavi town. In fact, just the opposite. The town was not even given permission to have a statue of the Shah. But control was as rigid as the central government could make it there.
Did Savak have much presence around there?
Savak had a presence. It was a word that was always used. And very quickly, as I got to know people, they would tell me about this person or that person who were supposed to be Savak employees and to be careful of them. a combination of the very strict religious sort of hierarchy in the town, or the religious strictures in the town, and the government presence made life rather straitened.
What accounted for the opposition to the shot? Was this religious reasons, or just
combination of religious, the fact that the Shah and the Pahlavi family were not, well, the people in the town were Turkic or Kurds. And the central government, the Pahlavi government, really never offered those minorities anything. There wasn't a feeling of kinship with the Pahlavi family at all. And the town itself prided itself on a strange sort of independence. There was talk for the whole year I was there of collecting money to asphalt the road from Kermanshah. And I remember talking to one of the other teachers there, a very intelligent older person, rather religious, the only other person in the town who spoke very good English. And when I asked when the road was when it was going to be asphalted, he said, "You have to understand, we don't really want the road to be asphalted." He said, "Every couple of years, they take up collections, and they announce that it's going to be done, but most of the people here don't want the connection to be made that easy to the cities. We prefer to be the way we are." I said, "There's a lot of bias against asphalting the road. People are afraid that it will bring in others from other cities here, and that it will have a corrupting influence on the town."
Very interesting. What kind of attitudes did the townspeople have towards the U.S.? Did you pick up any particular line of thinking? Or?
Basically, they didn't know where the U.S. was.
Yeah.
I remember once, as an example, being invited to a dinner, and I knew there had to be a reason for the invitation to me. It was a family I didn't really know well at all. I couldn't think of any reason why they would be inviting me. I had no real social connection with them. In the course of the dinner, the wife also came out and sat there having dinner with us. In this town, it was very unusual, because basically women were kept totally segregated, especially in front of other Iranian men, but across the board, unless it was a family event, the women were just not in evidence at all, not even for serving the meal. That was always served by younger brothers, young boys, the sons, or an occasional woman's hand coming out from behind the wall with a small tray attached to it, serving tea. But sitting down at the dinner, I sat there wondering what was going to come up, because I knew there had to be a reason. And eventually, the hostess got to the point. And she told me that her brother was now studying in my country, and she had wanted me to come to dinner, meet with me, because she thought it would be very nice if my family could perhaps invite her brother to their house for dinner, my parents for example, or just to watch over him a little bit while he was off in my country. I thought this was a great idea too, and I asked for the address where her brother could be reached. Well, he was in Germany. In the late 60s, in the early 70s, the United States for people in this town was still terra incognita. It just meant somewhere on the other side of the mountains. There were very few people from the town who had ever been there. In fact, in my whole time, I think I met one doctor who was assigned to the town to the clinic who had spent a year or two in the United States. That changed by the mid-70s. By the mid-70s, there were lots of people who were going out to the United States to study. And a fair number of people from that town also came to the United States. And in fact, now only in the Washington area, I know 7 or 8 people from that town. But this would not have been true in 1970. For the people of the town, it was a real trip, a journey that you thought about for a long time if you were going up to Masjid to do a pilgrimage or to home. Even going to Kermanshah, a couple of hours away, was something that you prepared for. You didn't just lightly jump into your car because you had no car. It meant a full day and the awful possibility of having to stay overnight in a hotel. It was just not done very easily. And people would talk about their trip to go shopping.
Mm-hmm.
You know, foreign travel was would have been considered very strange.
Mm-hmm. Were there any other Americans in the area at all besides you?
Closest American to me was in the village of Sahneh, S-A-H-N-E-H, which was, if you were driving straight, about 2.5 hours. If you were hitchhiking, anywhere from 3 to 4.
Mm-hmm. That's the other Peace Corps person.
Yes, there was a Peace Corps couple. Yeah. They saved my sanity at times.
Mm-hmm.
After 2 or 3 weeks of only speaking Persian and broken English, you know, this is the book, this is a table, that variety of English, to 200 Iranian students. One had to speak English once in a while.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said you next went to the Literacy Corps, Literacy Corps Teachers Training College at Mamazar.
Mamazar, yeah.
How did this assignment come about?
Well, I'd been asked because the normal the academic year in Solnhofer ended, of course, in roughly May.
Mm-hmm.
I had a small vacation, a couple of weeks, and then I was asked, and then I was doing a summer assignment. Seminar on the Caspian was due to run 6 weeks, and I expected to finish that, have another vacation for a week or two, come back to Solnhofer for my second year. It was partially psychological, but partially also because I enjoyed it so much, teaching the university students. And these students were literally the cream of the university crop. To get into the Literacy Corps Teachers Training College, you had to have been a Literacy Corps member for at least 2 years, which meant that all of the students had done their national service teaching in villages. There were also, that was one way to get in, but normally they had 3 or 4 years of teaching experience in addition to that. So I became a teacher at the seminar, which had roughly 100 students, but a teacher to students who all had very good work backgrounds. They were all very committed and basically very sharp. The difference between teaching 14-year-olders to speak English when they could not yet speak Persian and teaching university-age students who had had 4 or 5 years of work experience was the earth and the sun. It refreshed me so much and it was so stimulating that I welcomed the opportunity to, you know, take the assignment at the college.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a totally different life and a very stimulating intellectual life too.
Mm-hmm. So you said you were there all the way through 73 at this
Yes.
Were there other Americans involved in the college?
Yeah. Well, at the seminars, we had seminars for 2 years in a row.
Uh-huh.
And both seminars, there were a number of Peace Corps volunteers, 10, 11, I think at one point we had 16. But at the college itself, there was only one other American. And for my second year there, I was the only American.
First year, this is another Peace Corps volunteer
Yes.
also? Who directed the college?
The college was set up and directed by a rather well-known Iranian academic, Amir Abbas Birjandi, B-I-R-J-A-N-D-I. Birjandi was socially very well connected to the top level of the Iranian government. He had an access to the court. He had been instrumental in establishing the Literacy Corps itself, the very idea of it. And he basically, because of a combination of oil money and his own contacts, had carte blanche with the school. If you needed something, he would write the check out and get it. The students were treated very well. They were coddled, actually. And if a library needed books, or you needed typewriters, or this or that, or anything, he was there and ready to get it. He was very active, very involved, and a large number of students from this college were sent off to the United States to continue with higher education, master's degrees, doctoral degrees.
Hmm. How many students were there?
I'm not really sure. Several hundred.
Yeah.
But several hundred at a minimum.
Yeah.
The campus was beautiful. It was a literally park lovely buildings and was situated adjacent to a very old village. The village and the campus had a symbiotic relationship that was excellent for both. A great many of the villagers, their sons, daughters, were affected by the presence of the college and went on to educational levels they never would have obtained otherwise. But it was all the university students who lived in the village, rented rooms in the village, and the fact that the villagers got jobs on the campus, it really had an excellent effect on the village people. As an example of that, I can just recently, about a month ago, the son of one of the drivers from the college, the driver himself was a village man who became a bus driver and, you know, maintenance man at the college, but his son was just graduated from a university in Tehran as the top student in the university, and he has a fellowship to the United States now. Without that connection to the college, the access they had to libraries, the access to the facilities of the school, the sort of intercourse or the interrelationship with the students, I think this boy would probably just be, you know, another farmer in the village. And he's one of many, you know, I can think of.
But how exactly was that?
That also expanded. Yeah, yeah. But 50, 60 maybe. Yeah.
And you taught English all the way?
Taught English.
That was amazing. You taught?
Yeah. English, but also I was there as an advisor about American schools, American life. I did a lot of one-on-one guidance counseling, a lot of one-on-one help with translations. The school is very big on translating works from English into Persian. Iranians in general at that period were. Works in sociology, medicine, you know, agriculture, etc. And I taught students a variety of different classes, but students were either going on to become guidance counselors or high school principals, high school superintendents. Most of them were not going to go back to normal teaching. They were being trained as administrators. And a lot of them really required English. I also taught in the second year a couple of classes of students who were part of a new agricultural program and who were going to be going off then to work in the Ministry of Agriculture, not to go into farming, but to go into the administration of state enterprises and the Ministry of Agriculture itself.
How well did you get to know the teachers at this institution?
Very well. I'm still in touch with a lot of them, with their families here, within themselves. And the same is true for the students. I keep very good contacts going on, a very good relationship with a fairly large number of them. To the extent where we visit back and forth, I've had visits as recently as a couple of months ago. Phone calls frequently. Many of the students, of course, and the teachers are scattered. Some are in the United States. The school faculty was purged in the early 80s. Many of my old friends lost their positions and went to work in either other offices away from the campus or went to work as private business people.
What did you learn about the political attitudes of the faculty or students at this point?
A great deal about the role that the security apparatus had in trying to pressure people to keep them quiet. Just by, I lived on the campus. I shared an apartment with a couple of other Peace Corps volunteers in the city of Tehran, but I also was given a room at the campus itself in one of the dormitories. Because of that, I spent countless nights in both places with students, with faculty. It wasn't just going into school, teaching for 2 hours or 3 hours and leaving. My life was basically the life of an Iranian teacher. Because I was a bachelor, I also had very good, you know, access with the students in the way in social life. I was very free to do anything I wanted to do. I also, for my last year, had a roommate who was from the school, who had graduated from the school, was working as a guidance counselor in a small town about 3 hours away from Tehran, but was coming up to Tehran itself to continue studies at the University of Tehran. And so he was one of my roommates for about 3 or 4 nights a week when he had to do his school work, when he had classes at the university. But heard a, well, number one, I developed very good relationships, friendly relationships, or with a large number of Kurdish students from the towns of Mahabad, Nahavde, the towns that are considered to be the center of Kurdish activity in Iran. I went to those towns frequently as my students' guests and got to see people, places, things in those towns that I'm sure other foreigners had no access to, and things which even the normal Iranian would have no access to. The Americans are different. We don't come loaded down with the social hierarchy that any Iranian would have. Mm-hmm. We're free agents. We can go and sit in a peasant's farm, or we can be invited to the local landlord's house too. It doesn't make any difference. It's not true with an Iranian going to another Iranian town. But I heard a great deal and learned a great deal about Kurdish efforts, self-expression, semi-independence, autonomy, what have you, their dislike of the central government. Saw and talked to a fairly large number of students who had had police trouble, people who had been in prison, students who had been in prison for anti-regime activities, or activities which the regime considered anti-regime, reading the wrong books, making an off comment. I knew students very, very well who were taken off to prison, including one who died in prison at this period. I would hear a great deal about what was done to them at that point, and these were not people who were talking to Amnesty International or trying to make a splash in the press during the revolution. This was in 1971, 72, 73, when such talk was dangerous, but they confided in me as a friend, when perhaps they could not confide in other Iranians.
Very interesting. To what extent do the teachers share those attitudes or have similar problems?
Teachers had the problems. To what extent they share the attitudes? When I went back in 1977, to Iran, after having been away for a couple of years. I had left Iran in 73, came back once on a vacation in 1975, and saw old friends, went out to the school again, came back again in 77, and immediately got in touch again with my friends there, people with, you know, whom I had correspondence and whom I had visited and kept in touch with. By 77, there was a great deal of anti-regime sentiment expressed very openly, even by top administrators of the college. This would have been in early 77, April, May, that period. And a lot more open talk about what had happened to various students. That's when I learned that one of my old students had died in prison, for example.
Was there support for the Shah evident also? I mean, was there vocal support for the Shah in this period from other people, or
support for the Shah? There were very few people who felt any support in their hearts for the Shah. Support for the Shah was something mandated from above. Let me give you an example. In the year 1970, in the town of Songor, there was a holiday. I think it was the Shah's birthday or the celebration of the day that he had been saved from assassination, one of those holidays. I have a picture of, I took photographs of the dancing and the sort of speechifying that was going on in the central square of the town, the central circle. And somebody also gave me a picture of myself standing there that they had taken when I hadn't noticed it. But I was standing talking on the far edge of the crowd to a local official, who was a bank official. And he spoke quite a bit of English. He was the other person in the town whose English was okay. The English teacher spoke excellently, beautiful English. This guy spoke decently. And we were standing there chatting at the far fringes of this crowd. Somebody was giving a speech in the center. And we couldn't hear a word of the speech. Just about every minute, the man would say, Shalom Shah Adi Ameh, the title of the Shah. And everybody in the crowd would burst into clapping. And after I had heard, including my friend who was talking to me the whole time, and after about four or five of these incidences of everyone bursting into clapping, I said, why are you clapping? You don't know what he's saying. He looked at me and said, if I don't clap, I'll be in prison tonight. He might have exaggerated it slightly, but I'm not sure. As an official, he had to clap. And as an official, he would have been asked why he hadn't been clapping. But it was that sort of control, that sort of, when you say, you know, support for the Shah, yeah, you could always get 1,000 or 2,000 or 100,000 people to clap and to yell bravo and, you know, long live the Shah, but an awful lot of people thought of it as sort of a joke that they have to go through, just like all the pictures of the Shah on everyone's wall. Another comment about that, something that I heard in Tabriz in the year 1977. I was talking to a factory owner about one of the normal marches, you know, in honor of, again, one of the Pahlavi holidays. And he mentioned that he'd had to send 20 or 30 of his workers to the march carrying placards of support. And I said, well, you know, why do you do that? You know, he mentioned that he had practically had to close his factory down in order to do this, and how much trouble it was to get machinery started again and other things. I said, well, why do you do it? He said, we have to. We're given orders to do it. I said, well, suppose you didn't, what would happen? He said, well, now the way things are, probably nothing would happen to me immediately. But he said, when I had to go into the tax office at the end of the year, I would find that my assessment had gotten doubled or trebled. I'd have other problems of a bureaucratic nature like that. He said, and it's just not worth the hassle. That's how you get a crowd in Iran.
Yeah.
And it seems to be true today, too.
Again, how was the Sadat's presence pretty evident in this area also, in this in Ramadan?
There were officials at the school whom students told me worked for Savak. There were students at the school who were practically ostracized, whom it was believed worked for Savak. Just before I had gotten there, in the year 1970 in the school, there had been a big roundup of students who were accused of being anti-regime. And it had seriously affected the school. Quite a few people were taken off to prison. And it continued sporadically the whole time I was there. I can think of several students, including the one who was killed in prison, who simply disappeared, and somebody would come and empty out their lockers or empty out their possessions from their room, and that would be that. That's a Savak presence.
Now, you mentioned you spent a lot of time with the students on the campus. Do you have much contact with the townspeople?
Very, very constant contact.
Yeah.
I met by chance, several people on the campus working in offices who were from the village. It was really a large village rather than a town. And got to be friends with them, was invited to their homes frequently. Spent as much time in village houses as I did on the campus. And that included a whole range of social activity. Everything from, you know, just going over for dinner to frequently just, like, you know, sleeping in their houses. They contacted us, as I say, has continued.
Mm-hmm. They have similar views to the central government, they compared to the people of Sangoa?
Basically, yes. Yeah. There was a great deal of disdain for the central government, also a lot of fear. The town, a lot of the property around the town was under dispute. This had been an area that, up until the late 60s, had been rather remote. It was 30, 40 miles from Tehran, but in the days before everyone had cars and trucks, this didn't mean much. When cars and trucks became very, very common, late 60s, early 70s especially, the land in that area became very attractive. The Shah had a way of rewarding officials. Land that was foundation land, that belonged to the religious foundations or any of the government foundations, which was basically government control, such land would be given on a long-term lease to officials who, as a bonus. Well, a fair amount of the land in this area fell under that foundation title. It had been bequeathed in years past, centuries past, to either religious group foundations or had just become public property. And there was a very big dispute between the villagers of the town, or the villagers there, when a large area of land they had always considered village land, public land for grazing, was suddenly given to a general and his wife. The woman was one of the Minister of Education at the time. She was later executed after the revolution, or during the revolution. But the story that I heard in 1971 was that when she and her husband received this land as their bonus, they simply sent soldiers to clear out the villagers from the area. There was a gun battle, other problems, but that was the sort of thing that went on. This is after the White Revolution, by the way. So when you have people, villagers, who are being forced off land that they've considered theirs for centuries, sort of like the enclosures in England. Suddenly being forced off by representatives of the regime, by generals, by ministers. And everyone knew who it was, and she was there, her husband was there, his soldiers were there. You can't expect them to have a great deal of attachment to the central regime.
No. Now, from your vantage point at the college, what was your assessment of the work of the Literacy Corps?
Superb.
Yeah.
Absolutely superb. When I was in Songor, I visited a large number of villages in the Songor area. The way the school system worked was that almost every village had a school of sorts. It could be one mud brick room. And either a member of the Literacy Corps was assigned there to teach for 2 years, or somebody was assigned there, somebody, for example, in the Songor area, one of the teachers from Songor, somebody who had not yet gotten his university degree, just had a high school diploma, but had been in the Literacy Corps, would be assigned to teach in one of the villages. I got to know quite a few of these guys and would go out visiting for weekends. Either go out by Jeep or walk out, or go out on a motorcycle. And a couple of hours from Songor, just spend the weekend. And the social life was such that a bunch of teachers would do it at the same time. And all basically people in their 20s, young guys, would get together in one house in this village or that village or the next one. But I got to be close friends with a couple of the teachers, two or three in particular, and would go out to their villages frequently. It was really going back to medieval times. No electricity, no running water at all, not even pumps. I mean, you use the stream or, a well that somebody had dug and basically cooked over a little kerosene heater or charcoal. But talking to those people who were out teaching, seeing what they were doing, literally just seeing students who, young village boys, girls, who would study in that village schoolroom until they were in the 8th grade. But seeing that they were learning to read and write Persian, in addition to their local Kurdish. And also seeing the effects of that on the students that I had in my first year in Songor.
Thank you, Mr. Alvin.